Talking History on News Talk.
Good evening and welcome. We're Talking History on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, Churchill and Stalin, comrades in arms during the Second World War. Ireland's revolutionary diplomat during the Spanish Civil War and the controversy over his career. The Irish-born Trappist monk and writer who became an international phenomenon. The good and the bad of the Nobel Peace Prize. And finally, to end the show, we'll explore what life was like in pre-Reformation Dublin. But first, Churchill and Stalin, comrades in arms during the Second World War. Based on documents from the Russian archives, a new book charts the tumultuous wartime relationship between Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin and British Prime Minister Winston Churchill. It's a landmark book and it will appeal to all those interested in Churchill and Stalin and in the politics and diplomacy of the Second World War. It's called Churchill and Stalin, Comrades in Arms During the Second World War. It's published in paperback by Pen and Sword Military and costs £25 sterling, so about €28. And the three people who put it all together, Jeffrey Roberts, Martin Folly and Oleg Rozhevshevsky. And I'm delighted to be joined by Jeffrey Roberts, distinguished historian and regular panellist on the show. Jeffrey, you're very welcome back to Talking History.
Good evening, Patrick.
Can we begin with, I suppose, the insights that we get into the Churchill and Stalin relationship here? Because it's not as clear-cut as perhaps people might think.
Well, the book contains a complete documentary record, or nearly complete documentary record, of the Churchill-Stalin relationship during the war. And what it basically is the correspondence, the letters they exchanged, the messages they exchanged, plus the detailed records of the meetings they had together during the war. I mean, Churchill flew to Moscow twice during the war, had several meetings with Stalin, and he also had conversations with Stalin at the summit meetings at Tehran, Yalta, and Potsdam. So we do have quite an extensive documentary record, which is in the book, through which you can actually change the development of their relationship during the war. And it does reveal a very good relationship, lots of problems, lots of ups and downs, but overall it's a very good working relationship. But always, an intimate and in many ways an emotional relationship between the two men. You know, a friendship even, and a kind of friendship that persists even after the war. When the Grand Alliance has collapsed and there's a Cold War going on, Churchill and Stalin retain their respect and admiration for each other, and they express this directly to each other. So that's what you get from the book is the story of the development of this intimate relationship between these two political leaders, who in many ways are very, very different personalities, obviously very different politics, and operating in very different sets of circumstances.
Yeah, because we normally think of Churchill and FDR having that kind of close relationship, and this shows how, even though there were tensions and clashes between Stalin and Churchill, they did, as you say, build up this deep personal relationship.
I'd be inclined to say that actually the Stalin-Churchill relationship was even closer than the relationship between Churchill and Roosevelt. For this reason, is that the two men, Churchill and Stalin, saw each other in very similar terms. You know, they saw each other as comrades in arms. They saw each other as warlords operating during the war in much the same way. And I think, there wasn't the same relationship between Churchill and Roosevelt or between Roosevelt and Stalin. You know, Churchill and Roosevelt were political allies, but they weren't comrades in arms. They weren't warlords together. Stalin and Churchill were comrades in arms. They were warlords together, and they saw themselves in each other in the same way. And also, of course, they had I suppose Churchill did have quite a lot of contact with Roosevelt as well as with Stalin. But from Stalin's point of view, Stalin had much more direct, intense, and more extensive personal relations with Churchill than he did with Roosevelt during the war.
When we think of Churchill's relationship with the Soviet Union, it's usually framed by the famous Iron Curtain speech. But again, this shows that a much more complex relationship, because you could even pose the question whether Churchill was weak towards the Soviet Union in that post-war period, and would it be too harsh to even say there was elements of appeasement in the policy?
Well, yes, absolutely. Yeah. Churchill's, okay, of course, Churchill was the great opponent of the appeasement of Hitler before the Second World War, wasn't he? But he was the great proponent of the appeasement of Stalin, of during the war itself. So a big contrast there. Yeah, I mean, Stalin's attitude in relation to Soviet, I suppose, he is, you know, tend to be framed by two things. Firstly, that he was very instrumental in foreign military intervention during the Russian Civil War. So he was involved in the Western attempt to strangle Bolshevism at birth. And then the other thing it's framed by is, as you've mentioned, is by the Iron Curtain speech in Fulton, Missouri, in March 1946. But what happens in between? Well, in between, we have what I mentioned already, is in the 1930s, Churchill is opposed to the appeasement of Hitler. And not only that, Churchill is an advocate of an Anglo-Soviet-French alliance, Grand Alliance, against Hitler. Of course, that was Stalin's policy before the war as well. And then during the war, of course, Britain and the Soviet Union and Churchill, Stalin are very like close allies. And of course, you know, famously, as soon as Hitler attacked the Soviet Union in June 1941, yep, Churchill makes a statement, gives a speech in which, you know, he unconditionally pledges British support for the Soviet Union. Now, that pledge comes on the back of quite a long period in which Stalin has been collaborating quite closely with Hitler under the auspices of the Nazi Soviet Pact. So it was quite a significant thing for Churchill to do, and it was seen as such by Stalin in Moscow. So what you have here during the war is a convergence of political interests. You know, the political interests of Britain and the Soviet Union, the political interests of Stalin and Churchill. Obviously, that interest is the common interest in defeating Hitler and the Nazis. But you know, to achieve that common political goal relied on a very deep collaborative relationship, including a very close personal relationship between the two men at the top of their respective war machines. That's to say, Churchill and Stalin. Now, the other thing to remember, of course, about the Iron Curtain speech is that the main thing about that speech from Churchill's point of view wasn't the stuff about the Iron Curtain. It was about the special relationship with the United States. That's what the speech was really about. It was more about that than it was about what we came to call the Cold War. But the other point about that speech is that, you know, yes, Churchill does complain about an Iron Curtain descending across Europe, very famously. But he also says that what we need is a close relationship, a cooperative relationship with Russia and with Russians. So it's by no means a clarion call to confront the Soviet Union. It's a call to be firm with the Soviets, and on that basis to form a working relationship. And then, of course, what happens later on is that when Churchill comes back to power in 1951 as British Prime Minister, he's very much a peacemaker and an advocate of détente with the Soviet Union. He calls for a resumption of summitry, when he wants to resume the kind of conversations he had with Stalin during the war.
The book also gives you a fascinating insight into the secret correspondence between the two leaders. And then you also get all of these confidential communications between various diplomats and say, Stalin. So you're getting a very different perspective on a lot of the Second World War policy.
Yeah, let's be honest here. Of course, you know, this correspondence between Stalin and Churchill has been around for a long time. You know, it was published as long ago as the 1950s. So that is not new. I mean, what we do in the book is that we select the correspondence. Make it easy for the reader to actually go through what's the important parts of the correspondence as far as Churchill and Stalin is concerned. But what the book does offer is a complete record of the Russian version of all these conversations that Churchill and Stalin have during the war. I mean, that's the real kind of like USP of the book. And for the first time, people who read Russian can actually, you know, read these conversations themselves and arrive at their own kind of like judgments as to what was being said and what they reveal about the relationship with Churchill and Stalin. And I think, you know, and most people, when they first read these conversations, are very, very surprised at lots of the things they find in these conversations, but they're particularly surprised about how intimate they are, how close they are.
And that continued even in the post-war years. That continued up until the very end.
Yeah, well, the last time that Church and Stalin met was at Potsdam Conference, and we have the records of the Potsdam Conference, and in the book we reproduce the records of the two bilateral conversations that Churchill and Stalin had at Potsdam. Now, in these conversations, Stalin is very confident that his relationship with Churchill is going to continue into the post-war period, because, of course, just before he came to Potsdam, there'd been the British general election, yeah, June 1945. But the counting of the votes had been delayed so that the votes from forces overseas, yeah, the troops overseas, could be brought back to Britain and counted as part of the election. So there was a delay in the result of the election. And in the middle of that delay, Churchill goes to Potsdam, but then he has to return home to Britain to get the result. And Stalin is very confident that Churchill is going to win that election. I think it's an 80-seat majority. That's what he says to Churchill, something like that. Yeah, you're going to win. You know, the British people are not going to reject their great war leader. You're going to win the election. So Stalin's very confident that Churchill is going to be coming back to Potsdam. And not just that, but their relationship is going to continue for a long time in the post-war years, yes? But it didn't happen, as we know. Churchill lost the general election quite heavily, and he's replaced at Potsdam by Clement Attlee, the leader of the Labour Party. Although Attlee was at Potsdam already as Churchill's deputy, because there was a coalition government in Britain during the war. But yeah, so the Stalin's relationship with Attlee and with the Labour government is nowhere near as close as it was with Churchill. One of the things that's going on here, of course, is it's a Labour government. These are Labour politicians. These are Social Democrats. These are very much the political rivals of the communists on the left. So that's a big compilation there. So from Stalin's point of view, Churchill's departure from office is a big blow to not just his personal relationship with Churchill, but also the whole prospects for Anglo-Soviet relations in the post-war period.
Okay, well, the book is a fascinating insight into Anglo-Soviet relations, and a brilliant job, Geoffrey. The book is called Churchill and Stalin, Comrades in Arms During the Second World War, published in hardback by Pen and Sword Military. It costs £25 sterling, about €28. And delighted to be joined by Geoffrey Roberts to talk about it. Geoffrey, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History with me, Patrick Gagan. Leopold Kearney was one of the most influential diplomats of 20th century Irish history, and perhaps one of the most controversial. And a new book presents the first comprehensive biography of Kearney's career in its entirety. It's called Ireland's Revolutionary Diplomat, a biography of Leopold Kearney. It's published in hardback by the University of Notre Dame Press. Costs about €60. The author is Barry Whelan. And Barry, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you very much for having me.
Can you tell us who Leopold Kearney was and why he's so important when we look at 20th century Irish history?
Leopold Kearney was one of the first diplomats of the new Irish state. He served in France, in Spain, and also on missions to South America. And I think there's probably three reasons why he's of importance to 20th century Irish history. Firstly, he recognised the importance of trade in fostering closer bilateral relations with countries, and he concluded many successful trade deals. He's the first to establish direct trade with France during the War of Independence. During the Economic War with Britain, he successfully managed to secure trade deals with Belgium and Spain and other continental countries. In 1947, when there was the severe weather here that decimated the harvest, he was sent on a special mission to South America, secured the necessary imports of food that the country needed, but also established a diplomatic post for Ireland and Argentina and Chile. I think also he's important because he recognised that Ireland's economy needed to move away from Britain, and that has resonances, I suppose, in our time. And also it's important as a lesson in history that, someone who has been misrepresented, that, the full facts are known. And I think that it's this book has restored his reputation.
Talk to me about his relationship with Eamon de Valera. They seem to have been very close.
Yes, their relationship was forged during the treaty split. As everyone knows, de Valera sided against the treaty, and he seemed, when they first met, he seemed to have a very influential impact on Kearney, and they became lifelong friends. De Valera appears to have trusted him implicitly, even though Kearney never joined Sinn Féin or Fianna Fáil. And time and again throughout Kearney's career, because he ended up being anti-treaty, it was De Valera who intervened many times to save his career from pro-treaty civil servants and from other members of the establishment who were trying to undermine Kearney. And I suppose the relationship was also further strengthened by the fact that De Valera was godfather to Kearney's youngest son.
Talk to me then about some of the controversies and some of the misrepresentations, because it seems in particular during the Second World War that he fell foul of some diplomats, some people involved in this, and then subsequently some historians.
Yes, I mean, the book goes into detail about several of these controversies. I suppose one of the issues is Kearney's relationship with the Secretary of the Department of External Affairs and with Colonel Dan Brian, who was the Director of Army Intelligence G2. Both of those men were pro-treaty, and the files clearly show that they went out of their way to undermine Kearney. They didn't like this anti-treaty diplomat coming back into a predominantly pro-treaty service. He was the first to be brought back in. And throughout the war and afterwards, Brian even sent an undercover agent to Spain to try and find material on Kearney to undermine him. So the book details what they were doing behind Kearney's back against him. One of the controversial episodes of Kearney's career is when he met Dr. Edmund Wiesenmayr, who was a senior official in the SS and whose reports were being sent directly to Hitler in August 1942. That was a critical period in the war. The war was in the balance, and Hitler believed that prior to the Battle of Stalingrad, he had the Soviet Union nearly on the brink. And Hitler was already planning for the finishing the war in the West and how Ireland could help. And German intelligence realised Kearney's close relationship with the Taoiseach and Minister of External Affairs, de Valera, and they thought they could use Kearney as a means to pressure de Valera to abandon neutrality. And as the files clearly show, and as subsequent British files that were released showed, Kearney just upheld Irish neutrality and did nothing untoward. But then there was a famous libel case in 1954, where this matter was all brought up again by Professor Desmond Williams of University College Dublin in articles. Without naming Kearney, he effectively accused him of negotiating with Nazi Germany without the government's knowledge. Kearney sued him in a famous libel case in the High Court and won. Professor Williams, this had a catastrophic impact on his career, and he had to give a full apology and state that the statements he made were now proven to be false. But despite the Kearney's clearing his name in court, subsequent historians prior to this book have upheld Williams' charges. But I think the book pretty sure refutes that again.
And why is there still that that suspicion over him, or the feeling that he was misguided in some of his actions? Some have described him as being a monumental fool and so on, that there is still those criticisms of him.
Well, this book took 10 years to compile, and I managed to get access to Kearney's private papers. The family was open and available to other historians, but they didn't avail of that. But also I went to research in Spain and French files and German files and in London and Kew. And it was, I think, a lot of historians relied on a very narrow base for forming their views on Kearney. They're relying heavily on Walsh's communications with Brian. And it's when you see the full repositories that the full picture comes to light, and that he never did anything to endanger Irish neutrality. In fact, he upheld Irish neutrality probably better than any other diplomat during the war.
And what did he do in his final days?
Well, the libel case took a heavy toll on his health. He thought his name wouldn't be cleared before it was, and he suffered repeated strokes, and he died shortly after the libel case. But I think in a telling mark of his friendship with De Valera, the Taoiseach was there at his funeral.
Well, the book is called Ireland's Revolutionary Diplomat, a biography of Leopold Kearney. It's published in hardback by the University of Notre Dame Press. The author is Barry Whelan. And Barry, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History with me, Patrick Gagan. Dom Eugene Boylan was an Irish-born Trappist monk and writer whose two books, This Tremendous Lover and Difficulties in Mental Prayer, became international bestsellers. And the distinguished Jesuit historian Thomas J. Morrissey has written the first biography of this important Irish writer. It's called Dom Eugene Boylan, Trappist Monk, Scientist and Writer, 1904 to 1964. It's published in paperback by Messenger Publications and costs €19.95. The author, Thomas J. Morrissey. And Thomas, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thanks, Patrick.
Can we talk about this remarkable man? And I suppose the fact that people didn't think he was going to become a monk, and he caught a lot of people by surprise when he did.
Yes, that's true. He's in many ways, he's a man of surprises, because his whole way of life was very much a lively, sociable sort of one. Loved to sing, loved to dance, loved to mix around with women and so forth, and very popular with women. And then in very distinguished in college, in the sense that he did very well in his studies, took an MSc in physics, and got the scholarship to Vienna. But apart from that, he was in all sorts of societies. He was in the swimming club, and he was an outstanding swimmer, by the way, and later would represent Ireland in the Tolton Games. He was a member of the Science Society and was secretary to that, and member of the Musical Society, and then became auditor of the LNH, which was the big distinguishing point, because the LNH, as you remember, was the sort of the grounding for future barristers and judges and even politicians, where they made their reputations as public speakers and debaters and so forth. And even as a seminary student at Clonliffe, he managed to make his way into the LNH and to express himself there and take on other contestants and so forth. So not at all the type of person you think of as picking a solitude life in silence in a monastery. And yet that's what happened, and became very famous as a monk.
And talk to me about his two books, and why were they so influential? This Tremendous Lover is still in print over 70 years later. Why were these such bestsellers around the world?
Well, first of all, he wrote a number of books, but as you say, the two best known and the two that became bestsellers are the Difficulties in Mental Prayer, which was the first one. And that came about by virtue of the fact that he had established quite a career as somebody giving retreats and conferences. And after one such, to some Christian brothers, one of them said to him, "Why don't you write a book on mental prayer and the difficulties people have in praying?" And that was the first book, Difficulties in Mental Prayer. And it was written really for priests and religious and so on. But to his surprise, it became a bestseller amongst the lay people, and especially in America, but also across Europe. And he was very much concerned in the book in trying to help people to pray in terms of ordinary prayer and meditation, and then emphasize spiritual reading a lot, that one's imagination and one's mind needs to be fed by reading that will stimulate and help your prayer. And his emphasis very much was, in prayer, be yourself, use your own words to God. And use aspirations, if you like, during the day. But you're trying to get to know God, and he wants to know you. And so the purpose of life, in a way, he would say, is to unite us with Christ. That's the purpose of life, and that Christ is living and he's with us. And he wants to get to know us, and we seek in prayer to get to know him, and to do it as ourselves, as naturally as possible, and not to feel you have to use long prayers or anything like that.
He had a huge international career then in responding. He was much in demand for lectures. He started a foundation in Australia. He was in Wales for a time. He was in Kansas in the United States.
That's right.
But talk to me about his return to Ireland when he was elected Abbot of Roscrea.
Yes, he came back in 1960. And he had had a period when he was the equivalent of Abbot in Caldy Island. That's on the Bristol Channel off of Wales. And there was a Cistercian monastery there, and it was going on the rocks financially. And he was appointed to it to try and save it. He did so, again, rather typical of him, in a very individual way of doing things. He noticed there was a lot of lavender and flowers around the island. So why not try and build up a perfume industry there? So that's what he did. He, one of the monks was a chemist, and he worked with him. And then he contacted some friends in Dublin about marketing. And then when he was in the States, he was trying to market his perfume there, which caused a lot of amusement amongst the people in Kansas who weren't used to monks being associated with perfume and that sort of thing. So. So anyway, at the end of his time in the States, he came back to Roscrea, and it was coincided almost with the retirement of the previous abbot, and he was elected and became the abbot of Roscrea. And so he continued his work as a person hearing confessions for hours a day. In those days, there was, as you will know, there were very frequent confessions. People came from all over the middle of Ireland and the north of Munster and the south of Leinster to confession to him. They say he had an extraordinary gift for understanding people's difficulties and almost being able to read their minds. He studied psychology a lot himself, too, in order to help himself as a confessor. But he was always very patient with people and very helpful, and always a kind of very much stressed with the tremendous lover as well. The idea that God is a God of love and not a God of judgment and of rules and regulations, but a God who is interested in each of us and loves us. And that was his emphasis. That's what appealed to so many people.
He died in 1964 after a tragic car accident. Can you tell us about that?
There's a bit of a story in that. In as much as one of the things about him, he was very boyish in many ways. He loved fast cars. And when he was in Australia, they sent to Australia to start a monastery there. And he learned to drive there and terrified people. He was described as the worst driver in Australia. But it never prevented him from driving. So on the night in question where the accident happened, it was the end of the school year in December, and the parents had come to the school for the school play, and then their sons would depart with them. And he was there as chief guest master, met the people, dined with the parents afterwards, and then announced that he was setting off for Letterkenny, because there was a funeral in, I think it was in Derry, the following day of a bishop whom he knew and was a family friend. And this was 11 o'clock at night. He announced he was setting off. And it was a winter's night with frost and so forth, and some of his fellow monks tried to persuade him and saying, why not wait? Go in the early morning. You're tired now. You've had a long day. And he said, oh, no, I'll be all right. No problem. Somewhere around Roscommon, apparently, the car left the road and overturned, went into a field. And some farmer out very early in the morning in a tractor spotted it and fortunately went to his help. and got rang for an arrears, arranged for an ambulance, and ambulance brought him off to the hospital. And for a while he seemed to be okay, but he was thrown out of the car, and in the process, apparently, there was a he managed to get a jagged tear in the side of his body, which turned out to have affected his heart. And even though he seemed to recover after about 2 weeks in hospital, he then got a massive heart attack and died. He was 60 years of age. And some of the local commentators in the press at the time, you know, talked about the national shock at John F. Kennedy's death the year before, 1963. But that for the Midlands and North Munster and South Leinster, it was almost an equal shock when they heard in the news of Tom Eugene Boylan's death. And he was a national figure at that time, and so Taoiseach and President's representative and a whole lot of former Taoiseach were at the funeral, and all the local people from miles around. It took everybody by surprise, his death. But in a way, it was his life was one of surprises, and he kind of went out in a surprising way as well for most people.
Thank you so much. The book is called Dom Eugene Boylan, Trappist Monk, Scientist and Writer, 1904 to 1964. It's published in paperback by Messenger Publications and costs €19.95. The author, Father Thomas J. Morrissey. And thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Not at all, Patrick. Thanks.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. A new book provides an insider account of the Nobel Peace Prize. Drawing on unprecedented access to the Norwegian Nobel Institute's vast archive, it offers a gripping account of the founding of the prize, as well as its highs and lows, triumphs and disasters over the last 120 years. The book is called The World's Most Prestigious Prize, The Inside Story of the Nobel Peace Prize. It's published in hardback by Oxford University Press and costs £18.99 sterling, so about €21. The author is Geir Lundestad. And Geir, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be on your show.
Can we begin with the incredible and unique insight that you bring to this story? Because you had this first-hand primary source view of what was going on for so many years.
Yes, for 25 years, from 1990 until 2014, I was the permanent secretary of the committee and the director of the Nobel Institute. So I was part of everything that happened on the committee and at the Institute. And the committee is, of course, the body that makes the decisions regarding the Nobel Peace Prize.
Can we talk maybe about some of the controversial selections? Because it's interesting, the ones that stirred up controversy at the time. For example, when Barack Obama received it just at the very start of his presidency before he had achieved anything, or even Nelson Mandela and F.W. de Klerk sharing it was controversial at the time, or Gorbachev, Arafat, so on.
Yes, there are many controversial prizes. Gorbachev was my first laureate when I took over in 1990. And I had, of course, studied him as an historian. So it was a great pleasure to meet him and finally have a chance to talk with him and his wife. The big surprise was, of course, that we asked him many questions. He gave long answers. But when he then finished his answers, his wife answered the same question, although nobody had asked her anything. So she was obviously a very important part of the family, much more important than we had thought in advance.
Very good. The Obama one was controversial.
Yes, it was very controversial in America, less so in, for instance, in Europe and in Africa. But let me briefly try to explain why Obama did get the prize. I mean, he was a U.S. president who, on point after point, came very close to the ideology which the Norwegian Nobel Committee had tried to express pretty much since it started its work in 1901. I mean, he was all for strengthening international organizations. He was all for dialogue, even with rather extreme groups. But as he said in the inaugural speech, they have to open their clenched fists. He was all for disarmament. He wanted to do away with nuclear weapons. He was for democracy and human rights, and he was for new environmental policy. So this, all these objectives coincided,
I suppose,
with the objectives of the Norwegian Nobel Committee.
If he hadn't won it at the start of his presidency, do you think he would have won it 8 years later at the end of his presidency?
Well, that's a very difficult question. You never know what would have happened. But I think the fact that these these underlying objectives coincided to the extent they did was very important. And the prize was, of course, very unpopular in conservative circles in America, but not in all other circles, not even in America.
Can we talk about some of the omissions?
Yes, we can certainly talk about the omissions. And by far the biggest omission was the fact that Mahatma Gandhi never received the Nobel Peace Prize. After all, he was the major spokesman of nonviolence in the 20th century. So he clearly deserved it. And the committee had more or less decided to give him the prize for 1948. But then he was assassinated. According to the statutes at that time, posthumous prizes were possible. And Dag Hammarskjöld received a posthumous prize in 61. But the committee felt it was a huge complication that he had been assassinated, and it awarded no prize for 1948.
What's the purpose of the Peace Prize? What can it accomplish?
The Peace Prize is primarily a high honor, maybe the highest honor that can be bestowed on any individual or organization. I mean, this is from the title and of the book, and it's really a quotation from the Oxford Dictionary of Contemporary History, where if you look under Nobel Peace Prize, it says the world's most prestigious prize. And even conservative Americans, we've had some very conservative accounts from American historians, they accept this starting point, that this is indeed the most prestigious prize in the world. It cannot decide the most important issues of war and peace. That goes without saying. We see how limited are the powers of the American president. So clearly five unknown Norwegians cannot really decide about the issues of war and peace. But it has certain, some other functions. It gives a microphone to the lesser-known laureates. They speak and they are heard. It gives protection to those who are threatened. It opens virtually all doors. And occasionally, it may have some influence on international affairs. I mean, for instance, Lech Walesa, he always said that without the Nobel Peace Prize, he could not have done what he did in Poland. And what he did in Poland, of course, influenced the situation very much in all the communist countries in the revolution of 1989.
What do you think are the most important? You mentioned a couple of them, but in terms of the highs of the Nobel Peace Prize, what do you think have been the most important ones in the history of the Nobel Peace Prize?
Well, that's a very difficult question, but in the long-term perspective, I think the prize to Ossietzky, as I mentioned, for 1935 was very crucial. And the committee then stressed the fact that persons and institutions were very important in bringing about peace. I mean, until then, it has stressed general principles like arbitration, mediation, the League of Nations and whatnot. But now they pointed directly to certain factors being contrary to the work for peace. So I think, like many others who have written, that this is the single most important. There were many others, of course. I think in my years, the prize to Gorbachev was certainly important. Mandela, de Klerk, and everybody would agree on Mandela, but I think there's also a case to be made for those who make concessions which lead to substantial changes. I mean, many said that you could not have peace in South Africa until you've had major conflict to end apartheid, but Mandela and de Klerk were together able to solve this conflict peacefully.
Okay.
So I think that was important. Others, yes, there are many others of very different kinds. There are many roads to peace, so that's why the laureates are also very different. I mean, some are far to the left, some are quite far to the right, but they have a vision of a future, and many of them have risked much in trying to reach this better future.
Well, thank you so much. The book is called The World's Most Prestigious Prize, The Inside Story of the Nobel Peace Prize, published in hardback by Oxford University Press. It costs £18.99 sterling, so about €21. The author, Geir Lundestad. And Geir, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. A new book looks at life in pre-Reformation Dublin, telling of its ruling class, its wealthy merchants, its all-powerful traditional church, the city's personalities, and Dublin's unwanted Irish. It's called Social Life in Pre-Reformation Dublin, 1450 to 1540. It's published in hardback by Four Courts Press and costs €45. The author is Pádraig Slattery. And Pádraig, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you very much for having me here.
Pádraig, we might begin with the number of women in the book, because that was something that surprised me, that you see many women involved in brewing, being involved as merchants, that they're an important part of the story of the social life of pre-Reformation Dublin.
Absolutely. Well, right from the beginning, I decided if, in looking at the sources, if I came across references to women, I made sure I wouldn't leave them out. That's right. For instance, in the apprenticeship master system, women were able to serve an apprenticeship, but it required money. And for instance, in the period 1468 to 1512, about 700 people served an apprenticeship successfully. 70 of those were women. So it's about 10%. It's small. But so they could serve their time as a smith, a butcher, a vintner, cook, glover or merchant or other trades as well. But they also worked on farms. So they were involved with animals, milking cows, making cheese, making butter and so on. housewife would normally do that sort of work, but it was possible for a woman to live in on the farm at 6 shillings a year. It sounds very small, so they could live in, they'd get their board and lodgings, but at 6 shillings a year then, at the end of the year, they could actually buy a cow. You could buy a cow for 5 or 6 shillings. It was a decent amount of money, or a horse. But women also were involved in brewing, and it was a domestic trade, really. It was a thing that was done at home initially, and women were brewers. And they were known as brewsters, and they were also on the street, and they were called tapsters. And another job that women could do is sell fish. They could sell fish at a fixed point on the street. In London, they were allowed to wander around the streets, but in Dublin, they paid a farthing a week, 1/4 of a penny, and they could sell fish. But the most interesting thing of all was that I found was that, which we could talk about, refer to later in a moment, women worked in shipping. We can go into that, but they actually brought goods across the Irish Sea to Chester. And we can talk about one specific lady there. And of course, just finally, there were nuns, and they were probably saying their prayers most of the time, but out in Grace Dieu Monastery, around the site of Turvey House in North County Dublin. The nuns there were teaching colonial ladies how to be ladies.
Now, you've mentioned intrepid merchants sailing to Chester and one remarkable woman. Christina is a clerk or clerk. And it shows again both the sense of adventure, but also the sense of determination and courage with these male and female merchants.
Absolutely. The merchants in Dublin went across, so you would find there a good Dublin name of the time, Stanihurst, Richard Stanihurst. Another name was Ireland Usher. So the merchants actually went over themselves in the ships. But eventually this system was set up whereby it was possible for a general factotum would go over, if you like, or what they called a factor. And one particular man went over, John Wilkinson, went over 18 times. And I realise we can all count, but it's just worth saying he crossed the Irish Sea 36 times. And he did deals with 25 merchants, doing a deal on the quayside, just shaking his hand with them, say, I'll do that. But not to forget Christina, John Clark was going over in April and May 1476 with goods for other people. But he got ill, he broke a leg, broke an arm, something. He may have died, but Christina went over four times to Chester, carrying goods, like looking after goods on the ship for two merchants in each case. And she would have travelled over 1,200 miles all told. But the nice little thing is she was hanging around the quaysides in Chester and some guy came up to her and said, what are you doing here? I'm going back to Dublin. Will you bring back some goods for me? Picked up new business on the quayside in Chester.
Excellent. Now, the book ends with the Reformation having come to town, and that seems to have changed, well, it changed many things, including a huge religious transformation, and you have shrines being destroyed and you have books being censored. That, how big of an impact was the Reformation?
Well, in the period of the book we're dealing with, it was just beginning. Later on, I think it was going to be really significant. But things were happening in the period of the book. For instance, shrines were destroyed, we'll say, in Leinster, from probably parts of Louth, Meath, into Kildare and Dublin and so on. But you're talking about, in today's money, £500,000 sterling in gold and silver and offerings were stripped from the shrines. Some of the shrines were at Castleknock, Coolmine, Finglas, Newcastle Lions and Swords. The liturgical books, fascinating. I read about the books being censored a few years ago, but then happily was able to go into Trinity College and see them. And it is wonderful to see things like Sancta Clemente Pape, Saint Clement Pope. Pope has been blotted out. It's a manuscript, so there's ink there. Could be watered down. Sancta Linus Pape. Pape has been blotted out. Nice to see, you know, you hear about books being burned and books being censored. We've some nice examples of that, and they're still available in Trinity College. Lot of changes, of course. The administrators in Dublin Castle, where once the monasteries were closed, they queued up, said, can I have that? Can I have those lands? John Allen, Master of the Rolls, was given St. Wolstan's out at Selbridge. Patrick Barnwall was given Grace Dieu Monastery. Robert Cowley got Home Patrick and others. Now, they had to pay. The monastery lands were crown lands at this stage. But for maybe paying £9 or £12 a year, they could acquire the lands. And of course, there was leases with them. So it was a profitable thing. But there's no doubt that people looked for what I call desirable residences in rural County Dublin. Interestingly there, in Dublin, St. Mary's Abbey, for instance, was turned into a storehouse for artillery and military supply. That is the church. The church was used for that. Where secular buildings were available, of course, those who were coming in were quite happy to use the secular buildings. The Dominican Priory in Dublin, just behind where the Four Courts is now, law officers and judges walked into it, and it became known, of course, as the King's Inns, just like that. St. Mary de Haggis Convent. It's at the junction, I think, is it of Suffolk Street and I think it's Trinity Lane there. There's a Church of Ireland church there recently, and it became, I think, a Bord Fáilte office at one stage, but looms and woolen and linen looms were set up there. But just gives you an idea, there was a change of use, of urban use, if you like.
And that was Pádraig Slattery talking to me about social life in pre-Reformation Dublin, the years 1450 to 1540, and a very interesting book indeed. And I'm afraid that brings us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to everyone who put tonight's show together, Susan Cattle, my producer, and David Nolan on sound. Next week, we'll debate the legacy of Enoch Powell and find out what happened in Rathcoole during the 1798 rebellion, and lots more besides. So join us next week on News Talk. We've been talking history.